Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Brian Fishman, Policy Director of Counterterrorism at Facebook and former Director of Research at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. I'm delighted to be your moderator for tonight's program. Joining us this evening are Max Brooks and Matt Kavanaugh. Max and Matt are fellows at the Modern War Institute at West Point and co-editors of the book Strategy Strikes Back: How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. Mr. Brooks is also a senior resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Art of Future Warfare Project and the author of World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie War, which is a great read. Mr. Kavanaugh is a U.S. Army strategist with assignments ranging from the Pentagon to Korea, Iraq, and the Army Space and Missile Defense Command. Modern military conflicts can often be complex to understand. Max and Matt offer unique simplifications through their analysis of Star Wars. From the forest moon of Endor to the Middle East, the underpinnings of military strategy are more relatable than often thought. We're excited to have them here with us tonight to discuss the book. We'll also ask them to weigh in on current U.S. foreign policy. I'll ask a couple of questions to get us going, but please write questions on the note cards, and we'll get to the audience questions as soon as we can. Please welcome Max and Matt. So let me start, Matt, by asking you, as someone that taught at West Point, I understand how it can be a challenge sometimes to relate to cadets, to get them into course material. Where did the idea of this book come from, and why Star Wars rather than Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones or something else?
Well, we'll get there. We're going Game of Thrones for our next book. Yeah. But so I taught at West Point, and I am, as you can see, older than most cadets. And the challenge with connecting with cadets is that there's a generational gap. You know, there are things that I know, having been overseas and in combat, that cadets don't know or understand. My background is in the Iraq War. Cadets are a little too young. And so there's a generational gap. And from that assignment, I actually went to Korea and served on a staff that was half full of Korean Army officers. And there's a cultural gap there, right? Koreans know quite a bit about the Korean War, but not so much about the American Civil War or the Second World War. And so there's a cultural gap that you need to cross. So, because for two people to have a conversation about strategy, they need to have a common terrain, somewhere they can meet to have a conversation. And so the one war we all know something about is Star Wars. I get it. It's a space opera. People have told me that over and again, but it's a war. There are elements in that film series on screen that we can see in our real world. Blockades, coups, empires, elite forces, all those things. There are lessons that can translate, that can teach an awful lot of people and reach a wide audience. And it's not just cadets and colonels and Koreans, it's civilians as well. Civilians, as we just saw, it went out in droves to see the Han Solo movie, not as many as the studio would have liked, but still an awful lot. And so for me, this is a way of reaching a much wider audience in an important way.
Max, let me just, before we jump into some of the substantive issues that Star Wars raises, you're an author. As an author, you develop these sort of fictional universes. When you're doing that, do you think about their applicability and the lessons in them and how they could be applied in the real world?
Well, I always try to answer my own questions. That's why I write books. I write them for me because I don't know what's going to sell. So I always start with a simple premise, which is my own curiosity. And most of the time, my curiosity is about the real world. So by answering these questions about the real world, I sometimes delve into the supernatural, because to me, I find that to be an interesting way of doing it. You know, there's always that gap between entertainment and between true education. You know, you don't want pure entertainment because that's empty calories. Mm-hmm. Then people go, oh, that's so great. Ha, ha, ha. Ooh. And then they go home and they forget all about it. And you don't want pure education because that's...
No.
So you want to find a way to put it together. And by the way, that's the way science fiction used to be. Science fiction used to be ways of discussing things you couldn't talk about in public. All the great sci-fi of the 50s and 60s mm-hmm. would have been censored if it was out in the open. So you put it on the Enterprise, yeah. or you put it on another planet. And every episode of The Twilight Zone was about something like that.
Yeah.
So that's all the sci-fi that I grew up with, reruns of Star Trek, Twilight Zone, or new episodes of Star Trek Next Generation. And I always learned something. So I'm educating myself while I do this stuff, and maybe somebody else reading it picks something else up.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm somebody that has studied terrorism and worked on terrorism issues most of my career. And I think one of the interesting dynamics here when we're thinking about Star Wars is the question of, are we rooting for the terrorists in Star Wars? And what does that mean if we are, you know, if you're sort of rooting for the inverse position, how does that help? Does that hurt in the real world?
I think that it helps you to some extent, and I'm not saying that the U.S. military terrorists? Is the empire.
Yeah.
That might get me.
Matt does not represent the U.S. government or the U.S. military in this.
Yeah, that's why I'm...
Or the empire.
Yeah. Or the empire.
Neither of them. I just, you know... Yeah. I think they've got some good points. But for good or for ill, the U.S. military finds itself at a resource advantage against most, if not all, opponents on the modern battlefield. And it's very useful to be able to think through what our opponents might be contemplating or considering. So whether you're rooting for the little guy or whether you're rooting for the big guy, the value, I think, is just thinking through the challenge and the perspective and the problem. One example is actually Max's book, World War Z. Zombies are entertaining, but for me, I look at it as an opportunity to think through how we would respond to a global, fast-moving pandemic. 100 years ago, a pandemic killed 50 to 100 million people. We don't even know the specific numbers because it killed so many people so fast. And my next assignment is to be at U.S. Northern Command, NORAD, where part of our portfolio is responsible for protecting the homeland from such problems, challenges. And so the ability to step out of my uniform, open a book, and think through a problem in a different way, in a different context, provides value on the real world. And so I mean, I really don't take any position with whether we're the rebels or the good guys or the bad guys. I'd like to think that we're the good guys, but I'll leave that to you to judge. But I think the value is in the stepping out of your own skin for a moment and thinking through the problem differently.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll ask one final question, and then I'll get to some of the audience questions, which is, when you think about, Star Wars, the original film came out in 1977. When you think about it as sort of a blueprint for predicting what the future would look like, you know, I can think of a few things that it seemed to have gotten right. Drone warfare, for example. It doesn't seem to have gotten cyber warfare as right. But I'm wondering, you know, when you think about it in that sense of a sort of imagining the technological future, where did it get things right and where did it not get things right?
Well, I think it got the notion of over-reliance on technology right.
Yeah.
And certainly from a U.S. military point of view, because we have learned to become the biggest, baddest guy on the block because of our technological edge. We have the best machines and we can make the most of them. And we've been doing that since World War II. We have developed a system of systems nobody can fight. And that's literally what the Death Star was. It was built around a large-scale assault, which is our national strategy, a large-scale assault. And we don't understand about those little tiny 2-meter holes in our defenses that can blow everything up. And sometimes those 2-meter defenses are called Facebook during an election. And it can happen. And so I think that, yes, the metaphor of relying on the big and the bad over the small and the unforeseen, I think, is very prescient.
Mm-hmm. And the size of destructive technology, it's something like a kilogram of botulinum toxin can kill all of humanity. I mean, you do terrorism stuff, so you know better than I do. North Korea's GDP is less than Colorado Springs, which is where I live. Colorado Springs isn't even the biggest city in Colorado. And they built a nuclear ICBM.
Not Colorado Springs.
No, yeah, not yet. Not yet, no.
Okay. Not
that's
yet.
Up at the next, that's next month's city council meeting. And so the power wielded by individuals and small groups of individuals, to me, while I hold out hope that our world... You know, you look at Steven Pinker's argument, and I think it's the correct one, that the world is getting more safe and more secure, and people are, you know, we're not burning people at the stake like we used to, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But I do worry, and I'm paid to worry, but I worry about the destructive power of high technology and how cheap it's becoming. And so it's a paradox to some extent. And I think that the Star Wars films really, with the Death Star... The idea that you would have this like massive technological ball, right, that could blow up planets, I don't think we're that far away. You know, when FDR first envisioned, had the famous interaction with Einstein, where Einstein said this nuclear technology might be used for destructive purposes, I think it was here just a couple of months ago, one of the speakers mentioned that it was first envisioned to possibly be able to blow up a port. And now, you know, we've advanced to the point where a backpack can blow up cities or more. So that's the thing I think that Star Wars got right. Maybe not the specifics, but the general concept.
Interesting. Well, there's a series of questions here from the audience, sort of wondering what it takes to make good strategy and what are the biggest challenges to developing good strategy. And several of these sort of raise potential challenges. One is public opinion, and how much does public opinion? Another is alliances working with other countries, and how does that impact strategy? The media, which I think goes along with the public opinion question. When you think about what does it take now in today's world for the United States, I mean, I think you can argue that we haven't been as successful as we wanted to be in some of our foreign policy endeavors over the last 20 years. On some level, that suggests imperfect strategy, let's call it that. Mm-hmm. What are the biggest challenges to creating good, effective strategy over time?
So the very first consideration to me is that it's an acknowledgement of the competitive endeavor itself. The idea that there in strategy, there is always an other. You are competing relatively against some either enemy or adversary or the environment. And that's why actually when you hear someone say good strategy or bad strategy, you should not listen to that person after the end of that sentence, mm-hmm. because there is no such thing as good or bad strategy. Mm-hmm. There's only better strategy or superior strategy because it's always relative to someone else, right? You don't just do it in a black box. You do it relative to an opponent or an environment, you know? So that's the first...
Yeah. And I would add that military strategy is an outgrowth of national strategy.
Sure.
Who do we want to be? And therefore, the military is a means to get us where we want to go. And I would argue that if we're talking about problems that we have nowadays with our international strategy, it's because we are experiencing kind of a nervous breakdown here at home because we're not sure who we want to be. And I would go farther in saying that this is a return to the ever-present cultural issues we've had is that we are something the world has never seen. We are the world's first isolationist superpower. We're the first nation ever that became a world power and wasn't really sure they wanted it. You know, if you asked Rome at its height or the British, you know, if you asked the British during the Victorian age, you have an empire. And they would say, yes, we do. They were very happy about that. But if you asked us, the average American in 1945, you have the keys to the world. You know what they would say? Do I still have a job? That's all we cared. We cared about taking care of us. And therefore, our national strategy was about protecting us. That was the whole Cold War. If we don't stop them there, they're going to come here. President Bush used the same thing. If we don't stop the terrorists there, they're going to follow us home down the yellow brick road or whatever that was. So now the Cold War's over. We've killed Osama bin Laden. And we're back to this notion of, well, who do we want to be? And what is our role in the world now, if not a protector? And so you can see the schizophrenia we're seeing in our outgrowth because it's starting right here.
Matt, you said that strategy is an interaction between your side and the other. What are the differences in developing strategy, though, when you're thinking about a nation state or a set of nation states versus non-state entities like terrorist organizations? I can imagine some in the sense that nation states publish doctrine and those sorts of things. You can understand some of it. But are there other elements of this whether it's in development or measuring the effectiveness of your strategy?
It depends on who you're seeking to influence, right? Mm-hmm. To some degree, all strategy, the objective is to make the world different from what it is, to achieve some, you know, the world is A and you want to move it to B. You want it to be the way you would like the world to be, or at least move it that way just ever so slightly. With non-state actors, which is to say, well, terrorist groups and Facebook, I love the term non-state actors because it's kind of everything, right? Yeah. It's the target
where I buy
my toiletries. The Commonwealth Club is a non-state actor.
Non-state actor.
You know, you're focusing more on individuals, right?
Right.
Mark Zuckerberg. You know, there are some nation states, though, that behave more like that. So the classic example that everybody is well aware of right at this very moment is Kim Jong-un in North Carolina.
Colorado Springs has nuclear weapons, and North Carolina
sanctions.
Is a terrorist. Yeah. I have a friend from North Carolina that wouldn't appreciate that. She's a big Target fan. But whereas with nation states, they are bigger, they're bustling, they're
fixed.
Yeah, you know, they're boisterous. So, for example, if you're the French president seeking to influence the United States in a certain way, mm-hmm. particularly on environmental policy, you will approach the state of California very differently than you will the wider swath of the United States. You will seek to put leverage here with Governor Brown, and probably the same with Michael Bloomberg, some of the other mayors across the United States. The United States is a very diverse nation, you know, very, very diverse country. Whereas with many organizations, non-state actors, they're led by individuals that you can more directly influence. And so that changes the approach that you take. That changes the actions that you take to influence that individual.
I want to pivot just a little bit. We talked in the green room, getting ready for this, about, you know, Matt, you published in the New York Times talking about how you don't vote in national elections as an active duty soldier. Max, you talked about how you are a civilian at the Modern War Institute at West Point. You know, and the Jedi were this sort of, you know, tight elite, you know, Praetorian Guard of the Republic. How do you see the sort of lessons from Star Wars for the civil-military relations between, you know, a military force, effectively is what the Jedi were originally, and the citizens of the Republic writ large, and now our interaction as civilians with the U.S. military, which has borne the brunt of almost 20 years of constant war to the point where most civilians still don't really feel that on a daily basis. But, you know better than I do, and you both do, that the military and the army in particular absolutely does.
You want to do the Star Wars thing?
And then I'll do the...
Yeah. Well,
we're like a bad buddy comedy.
We are.
Good buddy comedies, they can just nod.
Yeah, yeah. We're two Chris Tuckers.
Yeah.
Two Jackie Chans.
Yeah. I'm Jackie Chan.
You know, there's the issue I've seen as a civilian, because I was invited into this exclusive group, and so I'm sort of a tourist in this world. And what I see is a very elite group of guardians, these people that safeguard our republic, like the Jedi. And there's a certain amount of pride in that, like the Jedi, that not everybody can be that. Not everybody can be someone like Matt, which is great. And it is a badge of honor. And it's not everybody gets to wear the uniform. Not everyone gets to wield a lightsaber. The problem is when you have such an elite group that then becomes insular, how then do you marshal the resources of the entire republic? And this is the issue. We have one of our authors, Steve Leonard, wrote a great essay about it, about how the Jedi became too insular and too elite. And so when a big crisis came at us, the republic didn't know what to do. They weren't ready. The Jedi simply didn't have the numbers, and they didn't have the public outreach. And that's happening today. Right after we had that essay published in this book, we were at a conference where Matt already knew this, but what I'm about to tell you, you're going to need Ambien for tonight, because apparently our reserve and our National Guard, as I understood growing up, were meant to stay on the shelf in case we needed them. They were the reserves. The idea was if we go to war and we really need the extra troops, they're ready. Not anymore. They are now in the active duty rotation. They are in the deployment rotation. We are using the reserves and the National Guard the very same way we are using the regular army. That means if tonight we have a big war on our hands, something in Ukraine or North Korea or North Carolina, if we have a big war, barrel's empty. We got nobody. That was the exact issue that they had in those prequel movies, that the Republic did not have a plan and did not have a reserve. And from that, George Lucas was predicting the situation we're in now, which is it's great to have the few and the proud, but when does it become too few and too proud?
You know, when you're in the Army or in any of the services, you have two identities. One is the first identity that you have, and that's as an American citizen, and that's by birth and circumstance. And when you join the Army, as I did when I went to school at West Point, you gain a second identity that comes as a result of belief and commitment. And so those two identities clash, and there are moments where there's a tension between the two. And one of them is with politics. And so to some extent within the uniformed military, one of our greatest traditions has always been that we do not permit tribal politics to divide our units from within, because we're composed of people from all over the United States, right? Kids from Alabama, kids from St. Paul, Minnesota, like myself, North Carolina.
We're North Carolina. They're becoming the running gag.
I know. They're not going to. People from all over. So we do not permit politics to divide us from within. But also we there's a second reason. We don't want the American public to ever look at us and say that army does not represent all of America. It represents one of the parties or the other party. And so we've maintained to the best and fullest extent possible, a principle of nonpartisanship, that we acknowledge that we're involved in policy debates, that but we do not take part in any party politics, which is why, you know, you raised why I don't vote. There are some of us in uniform, though it is our legal right to vote, that choose not to vote in national elections because we feel uncomfortable with exercising any partisan act, even in the closed voting booth. So to some extent, I feel as though my identity as a active duty military officer is so important, and it's so valuable to me to support that principle of nonpartisanship that that I wouldn't vote. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have my own opinions. You just won't hear them tonight about certain things. Policy, I'll talk to you until you fall asleep. But that idea actually emerges in many junctures during the films. You see in those first three films that George Lucas went to, you know, he went and did the episode 1, 2, and 3, went back and redid those. You know, our minds get hijacked by Jar Jar Binks. But there's actually some really important lessons embedded in those films. They're nuanced, but they're important. And one of them is that you see on screen the Jedi separating themselves from the military arm of the Republic, separates itself, sees itself as distinct and separate from the Republic. And that is frightening, absolutely frightening. That's actually most of the reason why I'm here tonight, because I feel very strongly that those of us with shorter haircuts don't engage with citizens as much as we should, or would be good for us, would be healthy, because we are getting smaller, and that's just the way war goes nowadays, and we're more segregated and separated from society because keeps costs low. But in March of 1942, my grandfather, whose watch I'm wearing tonight, served here in San Francisco before he shipped out to the Pacific, the island hopping campaign. He was at 1010 Bush Street, if any of you know where that is. My wife, I met her here. She danced with the San Francisco Ballet for a decade. To some extent, this city has been very good to the people that matter the most to me. That's the other reason why I think I'm here. I feel like, you know, I owe you all, the city and the citizens, a great thanks. So these interactions, these engagements between military folks and civilians, they need to happen more and more, because I worry what would happen if we stop having them.
And there's a dark moment that has been written about in this book, the dark moment where one of the Jedi, I think it was Mace Windu, criticizes openly the politicians. Yes. And without meaning to, he nudges Anakin Skywalker closer to a coup. And that is exactly why, because as a civilian, I was never really sure why the military never voices their opinions in public. And why, what I learned as a civilian, it is imperative that when a retired general writes their memoirs, they always put retired at the end of it. That is imperative for them, because you do not ever want to see an active duty or the perception of active duty taking aside. Because, to be blunt, that's how coups start. Because there are places around the world, there are countries where the military actively criticizes the politicians. And it is a matter of time before at 6 o'clock in the evening, your TVs go dark, and then somebody with a uniform shows up and says, you know, for the good of the people, to stamp out corruption, they always use that term or something or other. They say, we have taken control. And that's why in our military, it's, I serve, I do not give opinions.
To be blunt, it has happened before even here. The American Civil War was only so devastatingly possible because 27% of the West Point graduates in the two decades leading up to the war voted with their feet and seceded from the country to form a military to rebel against the United States government. And I don't say these things sort of to say that that's happening tomorrow. It certainly isn't, but it has happened. Yeah. And so, while a lot of folks would sort of be quick to dismiss that nightmare scenario, I think it's a very sharp reminder that even something that you see on screen in a movie, in a Star Wars film, It's happened before here.
What do we do as civilians, right? I mean, I think there is, because I agree, I think there is an obligation for folks in uniform to engage in settings like this and even those that don't involve Star Wars. But I also think there's an obligation for civilians to better understand how the military functions and really understand the sacrifices of the last 20 years. Because I think that's where, when I talk to folks in uniform and friends of mine that I worked with at West Point, that's where I hear the frustration, is that they feel that civilians don't really understand what they've been through and been doing. And so what's the obligation of civilians in that dialogue, you know, across the civil-military divide?
I mean, I would start by saying that there is no hard and fast obligation, right? I very much feel as though I really appreciate it when somebody makes the effort. And I can't quantify it. I can't say exact, you know, do X or Y, but I can say that it really feels good to know that someone has made the effort, a genuine effort. I've heard, you know, Sebastian Younger, the filmmaker, mm-hmm. has put effort behind what he calls Veterans Town Halls, where mm-hmm. on Veterans Day every year, he wants to open up American Legion halls and city halls and have people get, you know, come together and congregate and listen to veterans from all conflicts speak for 5 or 10 minutes about their experience. And I think that that would actually be a very healthy conversation. I was recently on a flight. I got delayed in Chicago, O'Hare. Never fly through O'Hare. And I stayed at the airport hotel. It wasn't good. And when I got off my flight, there was a sign that was sort of hanging down so that when you got off the aircraft and you walked out into the airport, you saw this sign. You had to look at it. And it was this very weathered, very beaten sign that said, "Thank you for your service." And it was this very pale yellow ribbon sort of interspersed in the letters. And when we get to the point where it's automatic, that part I don't ever want it to be automatic, because I don't want this to be rote. I want it to be genuine. I want to have a conversation like we are tonight. Frankly, everybody that's here tonight is making a real effort, and I appreciate that. That's wonderful. So I know that my words are fumbling, but I think that however we move forward, if you're a civilian and you're looking to do what you can, do your part, whatever you do, do it in a genuine and an authentic way. And I think that's what matters the most.
And I can say one thing that we have to really ask ourselves: what the hell does it mean I support our troops? Because I know where it came from. Came from after Vietnam, because we felt guilty about spitting on soldiers who came back from Vietnam. Most were poor kids who were draftees because they couldn't go to college, and the college kids spat on them and called them murderers. And then we all felt guilty, and we went, "Oh, I don't want to do that again." And then Desert Storm came around, and we invented this wonderful phrase: "I support our troops." How? We don't have war bonds anymore. No bond drives. No rationing. We don't even have a war tax anymore. And I even talk about the draft. We have no means. But here's what we can do to support our troops. We can look, listen, and learn about why we're going to war. Because let's face it, we are his boss.
Yeah.
We're the voters. He answers to the commander-in-chief, but we vote for the commander-in-chief, who chooses to send him to war and maybe get killed. So if we want to actually support our troops, then we as citizens need to take just a little bit less time on Netflix, not that there aren't great shows, and just a little bit more time studying the world outside. Because then when the issues come up at election time, we can make choices and vote for people who make choices that do not waste his life. That's how we support our troops.
You know, when Max says that, I actually take that very seriously. I serve the commander-in-chief, which is meant to be the embodiment of the will of the American people. I mean, I think of it that way. I conceive of it that way. And I do. I work for all of you. I mean, if I wasn't getting up and running in the morning, I'd feel sort of less like I wasn't giving you, not your money's worth, but, you know, what you deserve. You deserve a very well-trained military and folks that think very hard about these things. And beyond that, you know, an army doesn't fight alone. We don't fight wars alone. Societies fight wars. There's Brown University's figure for what the post 9/11 wars will cost all the way out through 2050, if you include veterans benefits and healthcare and that sort of thing. $5.6 trillion. And that's our money. That's the American taxpayers' money. I mean, if for no other reason than, you know, than that, we're involved in six or seven conflicts right now. And my future as a military officer and the outcome of our wars depends on wise citizen choices. So that's in a lot of ways why that book is back there on that shelf, because this is a way to have that conversation, to make the conversation more fun, to draw people in. And if that's where people want to go, that's where I'll be with a pen in hand, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. We have a ton of great questions here. I'm going to ask you a couple that relate specifically to elements of the book and some of the sort of more recent developments within the military. One relates to sort of the role of female warriors. Princess Leia is commander. We now have more women have served in, you know, combat arenas in the sort of modern wars in Iraq, and now more and more or in combat itself. That's a really interesting question. I think there's others here is talking about bounty hunters and where do sort of bounty hunters fit in the sort of, you know, and the way that I would relate that maybe to the way that we see modern conflict developing is this military contractors or something along those lines. Is that a fair parallel? What are, or is it not? What do you guys think on these two questions?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you see that even in Empire Strikes Back, the Empire literally had rules of engagement, places they couldn't go, things they couldn't do because they were for whatever reason, and they reached out to bounty hunters, whom they hated. Remember that moment where one of the Imperial staff officers on the Super Star Destroyer goes, "Oh, bounty hunters, we don't need that scum." Mm. And then the kiss ass right next to him was like, "Yes, sir." But there they are, and they need them. And that's a stark warning for us. What are we doing wrong, not as a military, but as a society, where we have to farm out our warfare to mercenaries? And let's call them what they are. They're not contractors. A contractor who puts up drywall. These are mercenaries. They fight for money. Yeah. What's wrong with us? We don't have people who are smart enough and brave enough that they can't do it? What's wrong with us, the taxpayer, the voter, that we look at Boba Fett and go, yeah, we need their scum?
You know, on Leia...
He can't answer that.
Yeah. No.
You ain't going near that.
I'm not. Yeah. I'm better than Boba Fett, though. I'm a lot better than Boba Fett.
You're not a bounty hunter.
Let's get
you're
that straight.
You're not a contractor.
Right.
You don't fight for money.
No, that's right. Well, it's a fixed
amount. Yeah, but you're... Right. You're flying home tonight on...
Health benefits.
You're flying on a transfer plane?
Yeah, it is. It's a red eye. on Leia, though, I think she... The wonderful thing about these films, to some extent, is that they mirror what's happening in the real world and they reflect what's happening in the real world in an important way. So in 1977, when we had the first film, Leia is the damsel in distress, very first scene, right? And women, including her lines, only had 6% of the script. You fast forward to 2015, you know, the new films. Leia's a general. The Jedi that's being trained has gone from Luke to Rey. We have a woman in the lead character role. The script's lines are now 28% female, which is not 50-50, but going from 6 to 28 is quite a leap. And in the real world, in the late 70s, when women would join the army, they would be handed a letter, and we have this letter. I've seen a copy of it that said, when you go to basic rifle marksmanship, we are sending you there not so that you can be prepared for combat, but just so that you basically aren't afraid of the weapon when you see them. That's in the late 70s. Now in the real world, there was just a woman, 4-star general that commanded the command that I'll be going to in a couple months, General Lori Robinson, responsible for the defense of the homeland of the United States. Women are going to Ranger School. Women are on submarines. Women are graduating from all of our elite schools.
And wasn't there on the subject of guns, wasn't there a Soviet female sniper that had more confirmed kills than any American sniper all put together?
Sure. The Soviets were ahead of us, at least in that way, before they tanked. But the thing for me is that I have a 7-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old daughter, and they have started to watch the films, and they're seeing this change, and they're through osmosis, they're actually learning these lessons. And just a couple years ago, the Halloween trade industry groups, they have an annual survey that tells folks what costumes kids are wearing. And girls, for the first time a year ago, the top costume was not a princess costume. It was a superhero costume. You know, girls see themselves differently, and part of it is the films. And so, what that can show us, what it can draw out, what it can put a stamp on is that American strategic culture, the way that we see how we fight has changed. The way that we see women at war has changed. And Leia is a very good way of looking at that. And I'm sorry that Carrie Fisher is not around to finish, to fully tell that, to end that story, period, dot. But she did a really great service in the course of those films.
Max, what is it like, you live in L.A., you come from a Hollywood family. What is it like to sort of come from that world of entertainment and then enter into this world of military strategy? And in particular, two specific questions that we've gotten from the audience. One is sort of how did Disney and the sort of Star Wars Enterprise view this effort, the book? And then, your dad did a great spoof of Star Wars. I mean, what's the sort of family story on this one?
Well, that's three questions. I mean,
I got to get them in.
Okay, well, the first one is the whole reason I got involved in this was because years ago when World War Z came out, I was invited to speak at the U.S. Naval War College. And you can YouTube that talk. And I think I'm flop sweating and I'm saying, are you sure you got the right guy? Isn't there like a Lieutenant Commander Max Brooks wandering around Comic-Con? but I must have said something because I kept getting invited back. And from there, I was invited to speak at strategic studies groups and then the Atlantic Council and then finally the Modern War Institute. So that's how I found myself here. It's not like I'm cold calling the Pentagon. I've got great ideas. As far as Hollywood, this is something that as a Hollywood brat really does infuriate me. The divorce of Hollywood from national security, because that's something we do really well. We're the idea factory of the world, and it astounded me, fighting Al-Qaeda. How does Al-Qaeda have better messaging than Hollywood? We are the idea capital of the world, and yet we're getting outrated and outclicked by a group of guys in a cave in Tora Bora. How did that happen? And that is the cultural divide. That is a cowardice, I think, on the role of the entertainment community, who are afraid of making unprofitable movies, but also afraid of getting hate mail. When I wrote the G.I. Joe comic book, I got censored all the time because Hasbro didn't want to get letters. They didn't even know what the letters were going to be. They didn't want to get them. I was working for Saturday Night Live right after 9/11. And the reason I think Jon Stewart became a megastar was because we dropped the ball. We didn't want to go current events. We didn't want to try to tackle these issues and maybe say something offensive, God forbid, maybe get some letters. So we went safe and we stayed mainly in the 90s pop culture mold. And yet America was hungry to process this new world that we were living in. And there was a vacuum. Mm. And Jon Stewart roared into that vacuum and did an amazing job of it. And it astounds me when I look at old Hollywood movies, because the truth is, if you are a historian and you've got nothing but pop culture, you know Pearl Harbor happened. You know World War II happened. You know Vietnam happened. You even know Korea happened. But you would be hard-pressed if you looked at just pop culture from 2002 to see that something called 9/11 ever happened. No movies, no television. Friends, biggest show in America, took place in New York, never acknowledged it. You know who acknowledged it? Spider-Man. Truly, the Spider-Man comic came after 9/11 where he's looking over the ruins saying, I should have done something. But how many songs, how many top 10 songs were about 9/11, Iraq, Afghanistan in the year following? No, we divorced ourselves. And I think, I don't know if it's mainly the consumer or it's fear of the consumer, because I know there's a lot of fear in the entertainment industry. And I think with a little bit more courage, we could get back on track and actually deal with these issues in a way that doesn't scare people or turn them off.
Yeah. I think it's... What about Disney? I mean, did you guys interact with the
no,
Star
we're still,
Wars?
I'm waiting for the lawsuit.
Yeah.
I'm waiting.
They're going to sue him, not me.
Yeah.
You know that they're going to... They're coming for him.
No, they're going to... Thank you for your service, but you...
Yeah.
We're on our second printing, maybe by the third. They might have some algorithm somewhere in like the Disney master control program that will say they're finally on their third.
No, I don't know. I feel like they're looking for new ideas for new Star Wars movies. It seems like the last one didn't go as well as they hoped.
Yeah.
Maybe you guys are going to write that next one. It'll be a buddy comedy.
Well, you know, maybe I...
R2-D2.
Right.
And C-3PO. Yeah.
As long as we don't do action figures.
Yeah.
As long as we don't do merchandising, I think we're safe.
Yeah. Spaceballs the T-shirt.
Which, do you know, that
sorry.
Is... That, no,
sorry, I'm
that
sorry.
Is exactly why that was the deal my dad made with Lucas. My dad was like, I want to do a spoof of you. And
really?
Lucas was like, fine, just don't take away the merchandising. And my dad was like, fine, I don't care. And so that's how they did it.
Wow.
Yeah. And then my dad hired Industrial Light and Magic to do special effects. So they were it was friendly all around. I can't guarantee for this.
No.
They may, you know, we'll see. If you don't see me and there's nothing left of me except a dust cloud and a little mouse ear hat where I was, you'll know who came and got me.
It'll be enough.
Mickey always leaves a calling card. Getting back to something a little bit more serious, we just announced that we're going to have a Space Force. You guys wrote a book about Star Wars, which is about war in space. What is the Space Force going to do? And how do you organize? I mean, how do you organize the Space Force? How do you build a military?
Hold on, I'll tell you exactly what it's going to do. Here's what it's going to do. The Space Force is going to take money that could have gone to veterans, training combat infantry, an assault rifle that doesn't jam, local interpreters for local cultures, and put them all in something big and shiny that never gets off the ground. Space Force. Yes. That's my opinion because I'm a civilian. Matt, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, Max and I don't. This one is pretty hot. It's pretty difficult for me to touch it with probably a 40-foot pole.
Sure.
I don't share the same view as Max. The simplest answer is protect American assets and interests in space. But I can tell you that this is the most significant and serious reorganization of the Department of Defense in 70-plus years, right? Mm-hmm. So there is likely to be a long and difficult process at getting to where the Commander-in-Chief wants to go. And that is as much as I can say about that.
And by the way, we have no cyber doctrine still. You know that. Like, we have the tools. We have the tools to stop a cyber attack. We have the technology that we can stop them. What we don't have is a single war plan to coordinate all the different agencies, that when we do have a cyber attack, everybody knows what to do. We have something called the National Response Framework, and it works for everything else, but we don't have it yet for cyber. And that's not going to cost trillions of dollars to build spaceships. That's literally just a piece of paper, and we don't have it yet.
We have several questions here about the sort of legacy of Vietnam on contemporary military strategy. And I'm, you know, to bring it back to Star Wars, are there instances in the movies, and I'm sort of racking my brain as I'm reading these questions, where, you know, the history of the Clone Wars impacted later strategy? What do we learn from that, where we do have these sort of touch points and these myths in the sense of stories we tell about previous strategy that shape the decisions we make down the road? What are those stories of Vietnam? Or do we remember the right lessons? Do we learn the right lessons? And what should we learn and what should we remember about that period in our history going forward?
You know, the strategies on offer in the films very much They're not strategies so much as they're very specific and precise. They're more themes. Mm-hmm. And if I can simplify a little bit, if you are the empire, you are seeking to incite fear in your opponents such that that fear alone pacifies them. That's why you blow up a planet, right? You demonstrate the awesome power of the technology, and it's so overwhelming, and it's so destructive, and there's nothing you can do, and all of your family will die instantly, horribly, and therefore you'll be paralyzed by your own fear. In the book, Kelsey Atherton wrote a chapter referring to this as the Tarkin Doctrine, mm-hmm. Grand Moff Tarkin's. Which he had such an amazing face, that actor.
Peter Cushing.
Yeah, geez. It's like a crater in craters. But when you look at the rebels, when you look at the rebellion, it's actually best characterized, I think, by a scene in Rogue One, which is, you know, the Star Wars, you know, it's a story. It's not on the saga plotline, but hope and a sharp stick. And there's actually a phrase in military circles that hope is not a method, hope is not a strategy. But the reality is that hope is really pretty much the only strategy in a lot of ways. That's the only way that Mao succeeded. It's the only way that many underdogs keep going. And mere survival and continuing the struggle. Convince your opponents, the much larger opponents, that there is no way that you'll ever quit, and maybe eventually they will give in. And you see echoes of those ideas in the real world with the Taliban, with Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. with various terror groups, with, you know, here in the United States, pacification campaigns. We were talking about the Imperial British pacification campaigns. Whereas it's hard to pin down specifics, those are sort of the strategies that are on offer. You could, rounding back to your original question about the echoes from Vietnam, you can see some of those ideas at play in Vietnam. You know, the Vietnamese very much were looking to prove to us that they would never quit no matter how many we killed. And the casualty figures reflect that. And to some extent, in some cases, we were looking to cow them with fear. And they didn't, and you know the outcome.
Didn't we drop the conventional equivalent of 3 atomic bombs on Hanoi?
We
it was something like that. If you add up all the bomb tonnage,
absolutely,
like 3 Hiroshima bombs.
I mean, it's breathtaking how much ordnance we dropped from the sky on Vietnam and Korea. And
Korea, that's true.
What was the most surprising find for you both from the book in terms of Star Wars' relevance to contemporary military strategy? I know reading it, the thing that jumped out at me, actually, Matt, is in your essay, or as I like to think of it, your takedown of Yoda as a strategist. If you haven't read the book yet, you have to read that piece. That's what jumped out at me. And so I think, you know, maybe describe that a little bit. I'm still trying to figure out how I'm going to explain that to my 4-year-old son. But what was, you know, that was most surprising to me. What was most surprising to each of you?
So for me, actually, it was in the process of bringing the book together. Mm-hmm. We were looking to bring together a very diverse set of writers and military folks. Because we kind of said, why would we limit the writing just to a couple of us with just a couple perspectives? Let's bring in many perspectives, 30 perspectives with hundreds of years of experience, strategic experience. And when we reached out to General Stanley McChrystal to write the foreword...
What do you mean, you did that?
Well, yeah, I did.
You can take credit for that.
Yeah.
You did that.
There was a gun involved, but... Yeah, like, hoping a sharp stick. I had the sharp stick at his back. You know, he at first he was hesitant, but then he said, you know, he told me the story of the first time he saw the first movie. So he had just finished Ranger School. He was a lieutenant in the Army. And as soon as he walked out of Ranger School with his tab, the first film he went and saw in the theater was the first, you know, Episode 4, A New Hope. And... that's when it in a lot of ways that validated the idea for me. Mm-hmm. If that person who is he's a couple generations older than me, if we share this common experience, having sat through the film as a young person, you know, and experiencing the film series, then this is something that's useful you know, beyond what I thought it could have been, you know? And I know that that's kind of maybe a cop-out to your question, because I think you were looking for something in the book. But that, honestly, when that happened, it felt really good. You know, it was an exciting find. Mm. It was a cool thing to learn.
You know, I think for me, as a civilian, it was a further step in this constant blowing of my mind that I have going in military circles, because I grew up in the very liberal West LA in the 1980s, where the military was always portrayed in this sort of post-Vietnam as sort of straight ahead, don't criticize, don't question, we're right, get in line, put up or shut up. And that's how I always saw the modern post-Vietnam military, this all-volunteer force that was all in lockstep. And maybe that was the case in the 1980s. But in this book, you see such diverse opinions. Not all of them agree with each other. And a deep need for intellectual growth and to question and to challenge within their own ranks. I mean, this book is criticism of military policy coming from the military. You know, I would have expected civilians like me to be critical of military policy, but to see people in uniform or just out of uniform to say things like, we can do better. This policy isn't working. This doctrine is not working. Certain elements within our culture need to be reformed. The idea of still adhering to those ideals and criticizing the methods because you love the ideals. To me, that is not just mind-blowing, but it's so reaffirming, because isn't that what we're supposed to do in a democracy as well? You know, this notion of love it or leave it? Well, loving it also means criticizing it. These people all love the uniform, and they love the service, and they love what they do. But part of that love means honest, constructive criticism and saying we need to do better. Things have changed. We need to change. And so reading these essays, I keep thinking, my God, this is not a culture that I see portrayed in Hollywood, even to this day. I don't see that level of critical thinking in Hollywood movies, because I don't think we ignore the military in this country. I think we over-worship it, and we want to put it in a box. And we want in our Hollywood movies, we want a military face, but not a military voice. And I stole it from the OJ show where Chris Darden character says, you want a black face but not a black voice. It's a great line, but it's true. We want to see our soldiers. We want to say, thank you for your service, but we don't want to hear what they have to say. And in this book, you hear what they have to say about their own policies and their own recent history and about looking forward to the future and being better guardians of everything that we hold dear. So for me, that was an incredible experience and an honor getting to read these stories and getting to know the minds behind them.
How did you guys put together the collection of authors? Because it really is a diverse and an interesting group of people. What was that process like?
A lot of begging. No, actually, it was not hard. You'll notice that there's an imprint for the Wounded Warrior Project inside the book. That's because the royalties, all of them, are going to the Wounded Warrior Project. So nobody's cashing in on this. Yeah. These people, like Max was just saying, they love what they do. They love writing. They love their job. They love serving. And the opportunity to speak to a wider audience, one short vignette or story is Colonel Liam Collins, who I know Brian worked for a little bit of time. His dissertation from his PhD dissertation at Princeton was on counterinsurgency theory. If I distributed copies to all of you, it would basically be mass suicide, because you would die if you read that prose. It's hard on the eyes. It's just difficult to get through. I wouldn't do it to my worst enemy. Maybe. But
Liam would take that as a compliment, probably.
Hey, it got by his advisors. He wouldn't care. But in his chapter, he envisioned a group of Imperial staff officers sitting in a circle talking about countering the rebel insurgency. So he's taken all of those ideas from his dissertation and injected them into something more interesting and readable. And it's a great essay. You know, so... the fact that someone like him, you know, like Liam, could write such a fantastic essay. He was motivated to do it. Like I say, you know, it's emblematic of the whole project because we had so many people that wanted to do what he did and do it well.
Well, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question. Mm. And so my final question to you goes back to the beginning of our discussion where you said, we are sometimes blind to that 2-meter hole that leads to the reactor at the center of the Death Star. What do you think of today? Where is our 2-meter hole? Where is that vulnerability in our society today? Or in our military structure, if that's an easier way to think about it.
Well, boy, that's a big question.
We have 2 minutes.
Empathizing with others, seeing another view, being able to get into someone else, their ideas, and very much adopt a new lens, see the world differently. You know, Luke Skywalker, when he's training to be a Jedi, Obi-Wan tells him to close his eyes. I mean, he was seeing the world differently. And in a lot of ways, that's what this book is meant to do. It's meant to, there's no secret formula to become a Jedi, to have that magic. But if we can learn to see the world differently, empathize with others and wield strategy, that's our version of the Force.
I think the 2-meter hole is the measure of distance between the American people and those tasked with protecting them. And I think that's our problem. And you know who understands that better than anyone? Our enemies. And Osama bin Laden was very clear about that when he attacked the World Trade Center. Hmm. He said, I'm attacking America. You're all in this together. You're all the same country. So an attack on some of you is an attack on all of you. And I'll attack any part of you. And we don't understand that. The Chinese understand that. The Russians understand that. Terrorists today understand that we are one country and we must all respond as a country. And if we don't do that, if we keep doing what that one soldier once said to Rumsfeld, remember when Rumsfeld said, well, America's at war, and with all due respect, Mr. Secretary, the American military is at war. America's at the mall. That's our 2-meter hole. And it ain't 2 meters. It's the Grand Canyon. And we need to do everything possible as civilians, as citizens, to close that gap and respond as one nation.
Our thanks to Max Brooks and Matt Kavanaugh, fellows at the Modern War Institute at West Point and co-editors of the book, Strategy Strikes Back, How Star Wars Explains Modern Military Conflict. I'm Brian Fishman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.